Imagine, for just a second that you are an ice hockey goalie.
Oh man, a stressful job to begin with.
Right. So you're crouching in your crease. The cold air is just, burning your lungs. And suddenly the absolute worst possible scenario unfolds right in front of you.
The dreaded odd man rush.
Exactly. Your team just turned the puck over at the far blue line. You look up, and there are, two opposing forwards flying down the ice directly at you. I mean, they're going at like 30 kilometers an hour.
And you've probably only got one lone defenseman desperately skating backward, trying to figure it all out.
Yeah, just trying to manage the situation. And as that goalie, your heart rate instantly spikes because you are no longer in a set, organized, fortified
Right,
position.
where you know exactly where every threat is coming from.
Exactly. The entire geometry of the game has just completely broken down. It's essentially a high-speed ambush in the open ice.
And as the goalie, you're trying to calculate all these angles on the fly, pushing your body laterally across the crease.
You aren't just trying to stop a puck anymore. You are trying to survive pure chaos.
And that feeling of chaos is exactly where hockey games are ultimately won and lost.
Which is why we're here today. Welcome to this deep dive, everyone.
Yeah, we are getting right into it.
We really are. Today, we are embarking on an expert-led masterclass on what happens in those terrifying seconds. And I want to be clear about our mission here. This isn't just a surface-level summary of tactics.
No, absolutely not. We're using a highly detailed, incredibly meticulous manual called Defending the Rush, Learning to Play the Game.
Right. And by the time we finish this deep dive, you, our listener, will understand the fundamental physics of why a player gets beaten.
You'll understand the psychological traps too, the things that cause defenders to just completely abandon their posts.
Exactly. And we're going to get into the intense rulebook philosophies that dictate every single twitch of a player's stick.
By the end of this, you are going to be able to watch a game or play in one yourself and actually see this invisible matrix of decisions happening in real time.
I love that phrase, the invisible matrix. But I think we really need to start by understanding the stakes of this specific situation, right?
Yeah, why dedicate an entire extensive masterclass just to the rush?
Exactly. Because it really comes down to probability, doesn't it?
It does. Rush chances, and specifically odd man rushes, where the attackers outnumber the defenders, are the absolute highest danger events in the sport.
So what do the numbers actually look like?
Well, if we look at published tracking data, specifically, this is from SportLogic covering thousands of NHL games, they found that a standard in-zone shot has about an 8.15% likelihood of becoming a goal.
Okay, let's just pause on that number for a second. An 8.15% chance.
Right. It sounds low, doesn't it?
It does. I mean, that basically means a goalie is expected to stop over 90% of standard shots when the defense is actually set up in their zone.
Exactly. But the minute the opponent gets that extra skater on the attack, when it becomes a 2-on-1 or, a 3-on-2, that 8.15% likelihood almost triples.
Wait, it cripples? That is a staggering jump.
It's massive.
But I want to push on that a little bit. Why does it triple? I mean, is a shot off the rush physically traveling faster through the air? Are the shooters suddenly just like way more accurate?
Neither, actually. The physics of the puck are exactly the same.
Okay, so what changes?
The difference is entirely about the biomechanics of the goalie, combined with a complete lack of defensive pressure on the shooter.
Oh, that makes sense. So think about what a goalie needs to make a routine save.
Right. They need their feet planted, shoulders perfectly square to the puck, weight balanced, and their eyes have to be tracking the release.
But when you are defending the rush, the goalie is forced to move.
Violently forced to move, yeah.
Yeah.
They're pushing hard laterally across the crease to track a cross-ice pass, or they're desperately backing in to manage the gap.
And if a goalie is in mid-movement, when that puck actually leaves the stick, they can't set their edges.
Precisely. They can't drop into the butterfly technique with perfect balance. When a goalie is moving, physical gaps open up.
Right, like under the arms or between the legs or over the shoulders.
Exactly. So if we break this down, an odd man rush basically forces the goalie to abandon their fundamental mechanics.
That is terrifying. And on top of that, the attackers have total control over the variables, right?
Absolutely. They
Yeah.
decide when to pass, when to change speed, when to shoot. You, as the defender, are merely reacting.
You're facing the wrong way, skating backward, and trying to manage an asymmetrical threat. The math is completely against you.
Which means preventing a rush chance before it happens is worth exponentially more than making some spectacular dieting play to disrupt one.
That is the core philosophy right there.
Yeah, and data tracking actually shows that odd man rushes are relatively infrequent. They represent less than 3% of all 5-on-5 zone entries in the modern NHL.
So we have this fascinating paradox for the listener to think about. They are incredibly rare, but when they happen, they are unbelievably deadly.
Their rarity is why preventing them is the ultimate goal, but their lethality is why mastering the defense of them is just non-negotiable for any hockey player.
Okay, that sets the table perfectly. So how do we actually defend this?
Well, before we talk about where to put your stick or how fast to skate, we have to establish the singular, unbreakable foundation of all defensive play.
The core mental model.
Yes. If you only internalize one single physical concept from this entire deep dive, it is this. You must relentlessly fight to stay on the defensive side of the puck.
Okay, I've also heard coaches call this being goal side, right?
Yeah, defensive side, goal side, it means the exact same thing. You must always, constantly position your body on the invisible straight line that runs from your opponent to the exact center of your own net.
Every attacker on the ice all the time.
All the time, no exceptions.
I always picture this like carrying a massive physical riot shield. Your absolute only job is to keep the bad guy in front of the shield.
I love that analogy.
Because the second you let someone slip behind that shield, you are no longer defending. You aren't dictating anything. You are in pure, desperate damage control, just praying they miss. But, you know, I have to challenge this a bit.
Hmm?
Because it sounds almost too passive. I mean, is great defense really just standing in the way?
It sounds passive, sure.
What about the highlight reel plays, you know? What about the defenseman who aggressively steps up, intercepts a pass, or strips the puck carrier cleanly to create a counterattack? Doesn't high-level hockey require taking the puck away?
That is such a common instinct, especially for really highly competitive players.
Right.
But it is exactly what gets them benched.
Really? Why?
Let's break down the actual physical mechanics of what happens when you aggressively try to steal the puck. To strip a skilled puck carrier, you usually have to lunge.
Right.
You have to extend your stick, shift your center of gravity completely forward, and commit your momentum toward the attacker.
You are fully committing to the gamble.
And if you miss that gamble, which, by the way, you often will against good players, what happens to your riot shield?
It's gone. Because your momentum is going forward, the attacker's momentum is going forward, and they just easily slip right past you.
You have just put the attacker completely between you and your net. You've lost the defensive side.
Wow, okay.
What is truly fascinating here is that if you analyze video of every single defensive failure on a rush, every two-on-one that results in a goal, every breakaway, it all ultimately traces back to this one principle.
Someone, somewhere on the ice, lost the defensive side.
Every single time.
Okay, let's explore that a bit more. Because hockey coaches yell a lot of different things. They yell, don't get beat wide when a guy is skating down the boards.
Right.
And then they yell, don't get beat to the middle when a guy is cutting into the slot. Are those actually different skills?
Not fundamentally, no. They are just contextual applications of the exact same instruction. Do not let them get behind your shield.
So if you're defending the outside lane and they blow past you along the boards, they broke the defensive side.
Exactly. And if you overcommit to the boards and they cut back to the middle of the ice behind you, they also broke the defensive side.
So gap control, which I know we're going to spend a lot of time on shortly, is literally just the art of staying on the defensive side while being physically close to the attacker.
That's all it is.
Yeah.
And back checking for the forwards is nothing more than the act of sprinting at maximum speed to reestablish the defensive side after it was lost.
Because if an opponent gets between you and the net, your structural integrity is just gone.
It's completely shattered.
This is a perfect moment to anchor this concept for the listener.
Absolutely.
If you are sitting on the bench after a shift, you're catching your breath, the red goal light just went on, and you are staring at the ice wondering how everything fell apart so fast.
Don't look at the spectacular pass that led to the goal.
Right. Trace the playback 10 seconds. Ask yourself a retrieval question. Who lost the defensive side?
Find the moment an attacker slipped behind a defender's shield, and you will find the absolute root cause of the goal.
It is the ultimate diagnostic tool for hockey IQ.
It really is.
Okay, so we know where we must stand. Always on the defensive side. Always between the threat and the net. But geometry is only half the battle.
Now we need to introduce distance and physics.
Yes. We need to talk about the concept that strikes fear into the hearts of defensemen everywhere. Gap control.
Ah, the gap. The gap is simply the physical distance between you, the defender, and the attacker carrying the puck.
And it is the single most critical variable in rush defense, isn't it?
Without a doubt. Crucially, managing this distance is almost entirely under your control. The biggest, most dangerous trap a defender falls into is allowing a large gap to develop.
Which is incredibly counterintuitive.
Oh, totally.
If I'm defending someone who is incredibly fast, human nature dictates that I want a massive cushion. A large gap feels safe. It feels like it buys me time to react if they try to deke me. Why is that instinct so wrong?
It feels safe to your brain, sure. But geometrically and physically, it hands the attacker three devastating advantages all at exactly the same time.
Okay, break those down for us. What's the first advantage?
First, let's talk about speed. A large gap gives the attacker uncontested runway. By the time they reach you at the blue line, they have used that space to accelerate to absolute top speed going forward.
And you, meanwhile, are trying to match that blazing speed while skating backward.
Right. And biomechanically, backward skating is inherently slower and way more cumbersome than forward skating.
Yeah.
If they hit you with a speed differential, you are dead in the water.
They just blow right past your hip.
Exactly. Now, the second advantage is time to scan.
Time to scan the ice.
Yeah. If you give a skilled playmaker 4 or 5 meters of clear ice in front of them, they don't have to worry about the puck. They can lift their head, scan the entire offensive zone, identify the winger driving wide, spot the late trailer coming up the middle.
They can essentially mathematically calculate the absolute best passing option. You have given their brain time to solve the puzzle.
Perfectly said.
And the third advantage. What else does a big gap give them?
A clean shooting lane. If you back in too far and give them a massive gap, they can simply use you as a physical screen against your own goalie and rip a shot.
Oh, and a shot from distance with a clean lane is a nightmare for a goalie.
Especially if they can't track the release off the blade because you're standing in the way. But a shot that has to go through a defender who is right up in the shooter's grill, taking away the angle, that usually hits shins or goes wide.
I want to use an analogy here to really hammer home the physics of this for the listener.
Let's hear it.
Imagine trying to merge onto a busy 70-mile-per-hour highway from a dead stop. You are sitting at the end of the on-ramp, your car is at zero, and you try to pull into traffic moving at 70.
It's terrifying.
It is. It's dangerous, and you are going to get completely blown past. You must use the length of the on-ramp to accelerate your car to match the speed of the traffic before you merge.
That is a brilliant way to conceptualize it. You absolutely cannot close a gap from a standstill.
But players try to do it all the time.
It is the single most common defensive error at every level of hockey, from youth leagues to adult rec leagues. A defenseman will stand completely still at their own blue line, just flat-footed, waiting for the attacking forward to come to them.
They think they're being patient, right? They think they're holding the fort.
But the reality is, they are the car at a dead stop at the end of the on-ramp.
Precisely. When the attacker arrives, the defender is moving at 0 miles per hour, and the attacker is at maximum velocity.
To even attempt to defend, the defender has to initiate backward momentum. But those first few backward crossovers are incredibly slow. It takes time to generate momentum.
And during those initial slow backward strides, the forward who is already flying covers ground incredibly fast.
So the gap, the physical distance between them, actually widens and opens up at the exact critical moment when the defender desperately needs it to be closed.
So what is the biomechanical fix for this? How do we build that speed so we aren't caught flat-footed?
You have to start your feet early. You must begin skating backward while the opposing team is still retrieving the puck or regrouping in their own defensive end.
So you don't wait for the play to cross the red line?
No, absolutely not. You read the pace of the attack, not just the physical location of the puck. If the opposing team is executing a slow, methodical regroup behind their net, sure, you can skate up the ice and squeeze the space.
But if they fire a quick, hard outlet pass up the boards,
you need to already be moving backward at speed. If you are already at full backward momentum, you can hold any tight gap you want. If you have zero momentum, you hold nothing.
Okay, let's make this highly tangible for the listener. We know we need to be moving, but exactly how close should we be at various points on the ice?
Well, the source material details a concept called the shrinking ladder of distances to aim for as the rush progresses down the ice.
But there is a massive caveat we need to address first with these numbers, right?
Yes, definitely. The manual explicitly notes that these specific distances are not immutable laws of physics. They are heavily dependent on your own backward skating ability and the specific attacker's speed.
So, if you are a slow backward skater facing a breakaway artist, your gap has to be slightly larger.
Exactly. Furthermore, the text candidly points out that while the neutral zone distance is traceable to published coaching manuals, the specific measurements for the red line and blue line are essentially universal coaching convention. They've just been passed down through generations.
But conceptually, the idea of the shrinking ladder is absolutely vital for understanding spatial pressure. Let's walk through the ladder step by step.
Okay, let's go.
When the attacker has the puck in the wide open ice of the neutral zone, so between the two blue lines, your target gap is roughly 2 to 3 stick lengths. Why that specific distance?
Because the neutral zone offers the attacker the most options. They can pass left, pass right, dump the puck, or try to beat you with speed.
So 2 to 3 stick lengths is close enough that you are a nuisance.
Right, you're disrupting their vision. But it leaves you just enough cushion to react and pivot if they abruptly change direction or try to pass.
Okay, so you are matching their speed, sitting 2 to 3 stick lengths back. Then, as the attacker crosses the center red line, you tighten that gap. You close it to about 1.5 stick lengths.
This is the critical transition phase. As they cross the red line, the attack is committing to its trajectory. Your gap should be actively shrinking.
You are applying physical and psychological pressure now, taking away their space to survey the ice.
Exactly. And then finally, the moment of truth. As they hit your defensive blue line, you want to be right up in their grill, roughly one single stick length away.
At 1 stick length, you are in total control. You are close enough that if they expose the puck, you can disrupt it with a quick, decisive poke check.
But you are just far enough away that a single sudden deke doesn't leave you completely stranded on one foot.
You know, the underlying philosophy here, the real conceptual aha moment for me when studying this, isn't the specific measurements, it's the direction of travel.
Yes, the gap must constantly, relentlessly be closing.
That is the secret. A gap that stays the same allows the attacker to maintain their speed. A gap that grows as the attacker approaches is a guaranteed scoring chance.
But a shrinking gap, that is a psychological weapon. It forces the attacker's brain to process information faster than they want to.
It forces them to make a premature decision, to shoot from a bad angle, or force a panicked pass, or to just dump the puck in out of frustration much earlier than they intended.
And the blue line itself is a massive geometric ally for the defender here, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Because of the offside rule, an attacking player cannot cross the blue line before the puck.
So if you aggressively squeeze that gap tight right at the blue line, you basically create a physical wall.
The puck carrier has to either slam on the brakes to avoid crossing the line and going offside, which completely kills the speed of the rush.
Or they're forced to try and enter the zone entirely alone, completely isolated from their teammates who had to stop to stay onside.
It's beautiful geometry. Okay, I understand the geometry and the physics. But let's talk about the mind games, the psychology of the one-on-one battle.
The fun part.
Right. If I am holding a perfect, tight, 1 stick length gap at the blue line, I am frankly terrified. I am terrified of getting completely humiliated by some fancy stick work.
Everyone is. A highly skilled forward has so many tools of deception.
They really do. They will fake a pass with their head, drop their shoulder, dangle the puck wildly, twitch their stick blade. It is sensory overload. How on earth does a defender not bite on all that visual noise?
This is where discipline has to override instinct. You have to understand that the puck, the hands, the head, and the eyes are all deliberately engineered tools of deception.
Their entire purpose is to lie to your brain.
Exactly. If you watch a player's eyes, they will look left while passing right. If you watch the puck, it can move 3 feet side to side in a fraction of a second. The golden, unbreakable rule of defending one-on-one is that you must read the chest and the hips.
Because physics dictate that the torso cannot lie about where the body's center of mass is actually traveling.
You cannot fake your center of gravity. Think about the biomechanics of a deke. A forward can throw their hands and the puck 3 feet to the left, but if their chest and their hips stay completely square and continue moving in a straight line toward you, they haven't actually gone anywhere.
Wow. So a dangle that doesn't physically move the hips laterally is just a magic trick? It's an illusion.
The puck is the misdirection in the magic trick.
Precisely. The problem is human biology, though. Our eyes are evolutionarily trained to track the fast-moving object.
Yeah, if you stare at the puck, your foveal vision locks onto it, and your feet will subconsciously follow your eyes. Your brain says, oh, the threat went left, so your body shifts weight to the left.
And suddenly, your hips are open, your weight is shifted, and the attacker simply pulls the puck back to the right and steps past you.
So how do you train your eyes to ignore millions of years of evolution?
You literally fix your hard gaze on the logo on the front of their jersey. You lock onto their sternum, and you just use your peripheral vision to vaguely track the location of the puck.
As long as you stay directly in front of their chest, their body cannot pass through yours, regardless of what the puck is doing.
This requires an incredible amount of mental discipline. Your brain is screaming, look at the rubber disc, that's the thing that scores goals. But you have to force yourself to look at the chest.
And while your eyes and feet are managing the body, your stick has to be doing work too, right?
Yes. Your stick is your passive structural weapon. You must keep the blade flat on the ice, extended out in front of you.
Specifically, you want that stick blade sitting in the passing lane, the invisible line between the puck carrier and their most dangerous teammate.
And you hold it with one hand to maximize your reach and wingspan, but you are ready to clamp down with two hands for strength if you need to battle for a loose puck.
But the blade absolutely has to be on the ice. I see guys all the time skating backward with their stick hovering around their waist.
Oh, a stick in the air defends absolutely nothing. It is useless. It doesn't block passes. And it takes way too long to drop it to the ice to poke the puck.
Furthermore, you only ever initiate a poke check when you can genuinely physically reach the puck without altering your skating posture. You never use the poke check as a desperate hope.
Because if you lunge to poke the puck and miss...
If you lunge, you shift your weight off your skating edges. You're essentially falling forward. Your extended stick just becomes a physical fulcrum that the attacker pivots around.
And because you are off balance and falling, your stick usually ends up tangling in their skates, which results in you taking a tripping penalty.
You lose the battle, you lose the defensive side, and you put your team on the penalty kill.
Okay, so we have the speed, we have the gap, we know we are staring at the chest, and our stick is on the ice. We are perfectly positioned. Now, geographically, where are we trying to physically direct this puck carrier? We don't just want to skate backward forever.
Right. The ultimate goal of gap control is to angle the attacker to the outside of the rink. You want to deny them access to the dangerous middle ice, the high slot between the face-off circles.
If we go back to probability, shots from the high danger slot beat goalies consistently.
But shots from the outside wall, down by the face-off dots, generally do not, because the goalie has the angle completely covered.
So how do we force them out there?
You use your body positioning. You don't line up perfectly nose to nose with them. You position yourself slightly inside toward the center of the ice.
You want to align your board side shoulder, the shoulder closest to the wall, roughly with the exact middle of their chest, right?
Exactly. By doing this, your physical body acts as a wall blocking their path to the center. You're giving them a runway, but the runway only leads toward the boards.
You are essentially using the boards as a second stationary defender. They simply run out of real estate. They hit the wall.
But here is where this deep dive gets really interesting and where we need to heavily lean on the source material.
We need to talk about the intense legal reality of using the boards as a weapon.
This is a critical transition because physical hockey IQ is inextricably linked to legal IQ. A great defensive play in one league is literally an ejectable offense in another.
The manual goes into immense, painstaking detail to unpack the massive philosophical and legal difference between steering an opponent to the boards and riding them violently into the boards.
Let's break down the physical mechanics of this for the listener, because the distinction is vital. Steering a puck carrier toward the wall relies entirely on your skating route and your geometric angle.
You're just taking away the ice, and this is legal everywhere, correct? Even in leagues that completely ban body checking, using your body position to angle someone is allowed.
That is correct. If you look at USA Hockey's philosophy for youth leagues, they explicitly define angling as a foundational legal defensive skill. You are allowed to skate into the path of an opponent to force them to change direction.
And Hockey Canada's interpretations are similar, right?
Yes. A player may steer or direct an opponent into the boards without touching them, provided they don't intentionally bump, push, or shove them with force.
And what about the professional levels?
Interestingly, the NHL and IIHF rulebooks don't actually print the words angling or steer anywhere in their texts.
Oh, really?
Yeah. At that level, the legality rests entirely on the absence of a prohibition. There is no rule against skating in front of someone. So universally, across all of hockey, taking away the ice with your route is legal.
But riding them into the wall, making forceful physical contact to pin them, crush them, or separate them from the puck against the boards is a totally different physical act.
And the legal limitations on this act are shockingly strict, and they vary wildly depending on what country you're in and what level you are playing.
Let's start with the non-checking environment, because a massive percentage of our listeners probably play under these rules.
Under USA Hockey Rule 604, intentional body checking is strictly banned for all 12 and under leagues, all girls and women's classifications regardless of age, and all non-check adult recreational leagues.
Under Hockey Canada Rule 7.3, the ban applies to U13 and below, female hockey, and any local recreational division that chooses to adopt it.
And the rules get even more granular and restrictive in women's hockey playing under international IIHF rules, right?
Yes. The text notes that every level of UK hockey, for instance, runs the IIHF book.
The IIHF rulebook governs all international play, including the Olympics. IIHF Rule 101.1 is specific to women's hockey, and its philosophy is incredibly rigid.
It explicitly forbids using the boards to make contact with, push, or pin an opponent who is competing for the puck.
Wait, so if I angle a player to the wall perfectly, I can't even lean on them to pin them against the boards to wait for help?
Under IIHF women's rules, no, you cannot pin. Furthermore, any move by a player to physically step or glide into an opposing player to initiate contact is assessed at least a minor penalty for an illegal hit.
The philosophical mandate is clear. You must play the puck, not the player's body.
So the practical application for a listener playing in an adult non-check rec league or a woman playing IIHF hockey is that the old school coaching instruction to ride them into the boards and finish your check is catastrophic advice.
It'll put you in the penalty box immediately. Your physical job is to pin the puck against the wall with your stick, not to pin the person with your body.
Exactly. You use your angle to take away space and your stick to take away the puck.
But what if I am playing in a full contact checking league, say the NHL, or a high level junior men's league in Canada? Can I just line a guy up and crush him into the boards to stop the rush?
This is perhaps the biggest misconception in physical hockey. Even in full contact checking leagues, driving an opponent violently into the boards is heavily, heavily regulated by the boarding rules.
Many players mistakenly believe that boarding only applies if the opponent is defenseless, meaning they have their back turned or they don't see the hit coming.
That is legally and historically false. Let's look at the underlying philosophy of the rule books here.
The NHL and IIHF, along with Hockey Canada, do mention the concept of checking a defenseless opponent in their boarding criteria. However, USA Hockey doesn't even ask the defenseless question in its primary boarding rule.
USA Hockey defines boarding simply by the physical result. If your action causes the opponent to be thrown dangerously into the boards, it is boarding, regardless of whether they saw you coming or had their head up.
And even in the NHL and Hockey Canada, where defenseless is a key word, it isn't the only test.
Yeah.
The source text points out a glaring exception that happens multiple times a game, the race for an iced puck.
This is the perfect example to illustrate the danger. Think about a race for an icing. A defender and an attacker are both skating flat out, shoulder to shoulder, eyes on the puck heading toward the end boards.
Neither player is defenseless in the traditional sense. They are both highly engaged, expecting physical contact.
Yep. NHL, IIHF, and Hockey Canada rules explicitly state that unnecessary contact with a player on an icing or offside play that results in them violently hitting the boards is boarding.
USA Hockey reaches the exact same conclusion under its specific icing rules.
Because the physics of hitting the wall at high speed are so inherently dangerous that the rulebook completely removes the right to initiate that contact, even if it's shoulder to shoulder.
Exactly. And the penalties for getting this wrong are severe. You cannot mathematically plan a defensive strategy around taking a simple 2-minute minor and killing it off.
Why not?
Because the rulebooks increasingly refuse to let boarding be a simple minor penalty. The NHL and Hockey Canada leave assessing a major penalty to the referee's discretion based on the violence of the impact, and they mandate an automatic game misconduct ejection from the game if there is any injury to the head or face.
The IIHF is even harsher. They assess a major plus a game misconduct for reckless endangerment even if nobody is hurt.
In USA Hockey.
USA Hockey writes absolutely no provision for a bare minor penalty for boarding. It does not exist in their book. A boarding call in USA Hockey starts at a minor accompanied by a 10-minute misconduct and rapidly scales up to a major plus a game misconduct or a match penalty depending on severity.
The takeaway for our listener here is profound. Knowing how to defend the rush geometrically and physically is totally useless if you don't possess the exact legal IQ required for the specific league you were playing in.
The exact same physical shoulder pin that wins you a defensive battle in the NHL will get you ejected in a UK women's game or a USA hockey adult non-Czech league. You have to know where the legal line is drawn.
It is the invisible architecture governing every physical decision.
Okay, let's take a quick breath and synthesize what we've built so far. We are layering these concepts deliberately for you to remember them. What is the fundamental structure we have established for the solo defender?
First, the core mental model. Relentlessly maintain the defensive side of the puck. Do not lunge, do not gamble. Stay between the threat and your net.
Second, the physics of gap control. You cannot merge onto a highway from a dead stop. You must generate backward momentum early, reading the play so you can match their speed.
Third, the psychology of vision. Read the chest and hips to defeat deception. Let your peripheral vision track the puck and keep your stick flat on the ice in the passing lane.
And finally, use geometry to angle them to the boards, but understand the strict legal boundaries of physical contact in your specific league.
That is a phenomenal foundation. But so far, we have been talking as if this is a purely isolated one-on-one duel in a vacuum.
And hockey is a team sport. Gap control is a defense's job. But stopping an odd man rush requires the forwards to get back and help. If they don't, the geometry breaks down again.
So let's expand our scope and move into the team dynamics of back checking.
This is where we integrate the forwards into the mental model. A defenseman can hold a perfect gap, angle the carrier to the boards, and do everything right. But if the back checkers don't arrive to disrupt the secondary attackers, the play will still result in a high danger scoring chance.
To understand back checking, we first have to understand how coaches visually divide the ice. It's not just a big sheet of white.
Correct. Tactically, think of the ice as being sliced into three vertical lanes running the entire length of the rink. You have two outside lanes running along the boards and one critical middle lane running straight down the center, right between the face-off dots.
The absolute standard foundational assignment in hockey is that the two back-checking wingers are responsible for sprinting back and owning the two outside lanes, while the back-checking center is responsible for owning the middle lane.
And the source manual points out something terrifying about that middle lane. It contains a player known as the invisible threat.
Ah, the middle lane driver.
Yeah.
This is the attacking player who does not currently have the puck, but is skating as hard as humanly possible, straight down the center seam of the ice, directly toward the high-danger slot in front of your goalie.
The manual highlights this player as the single most dangerous person on the ice during a rush, and ironically, they are simultaneously the assignment most frequently missed by the defending team.
I want to explore the psychology of this. Why on earth do professional athletes who study film for hours consistently miss the most dangerous guy on the ice?
I think it comes down to human biology again. We are visual creatures, like moths to a flame. The puck is the flame.
It is the visual magnet of the game.
Right. If the opposing winger is carrying the puck down the outside lane along the boards, every single defender's eyes naturally gravitate toward the wall. They watch the puck carrier.
The defenseman is focused on their gap, the goalie is tracking the angle, and the back-checking forwards are watching to see if a turnover happens.
And while all five sets of defensive eyes are glued to the boards, that middle lane driver just slips quietly into the high slot, completely unmarked, waiting for a simple pass.
It is a devastating cognitive trap. You literally have to train your brain to break its natural instinct. You have to force yourself to look away from the rubber disc and aggressively scan the empty ice for the unmarked man.
Which leads us directly to the golden rule of back checking.
The golden rule is this: do not decide mid-rush to abandon your lane assignment and chase the puck carrier if your defenseman already has them engaged.
This happens constantly in recreational hockey. A forward busts their lungs skating 150 feet back down the ice. They see their defenseman battling the puck carrier in the corner or along the wall.
The forward's adrenaline is pumping. They want to help, so they dive into the battle to double-team the puck carrier and try to steal it.
It feels like a maximum effort, but structurally, it is a terrible mistake. By diving into a battle that your defenseman is already fighting, you have just left your actual assignment. Usually that middle lane driver or a late arriving trailer, completely wide open.
You have taken a mathematically manageable 3-on-2 situation and voluntarily turned it into a disaster. You now have two defenders neutralizing one attacker on the wall, leaving the most dangerous attacker standing alone in front of your goalie.
So what is the physical action the forward must take?
Your job as a back checker is to find the player that nobody else has. You must skate right past the shiny puck battle on the wall. Trust your defensemen to win their one-on-one engagement. Scan the ice, find the unmarked man in the middle lane, and establish the defensive side on them.
Now, skating hard isn't a tactic. The manual outlines four distinct named systems of backchecking. This is where teams make structural choices about how they want to defend.
Let's walk through the mechanics of these systems so our listener can identify what they're watching on TV or understand what their coach is asking them to do.
Let's start with System 1, the defense early strike. This system actually triggers before the rush truly begins.
Normally, as an opponent breaks the puck out of their zone, the defensemen start sinking deep into the neutral zone to build their backward gap. But in the early strike, they aggressively tighten up. The defenseman on the wide side suddenly strikes laterally across the ice directly at the puck carrier.
The goal here is ambush. You surprise the carrier and deny them the time and space they expected to have to build speed.
Exactly. System 2 is more structural. It's called the wide lane lock. In this system, the very first forward who backchecks immediately claims an outside lane along the boards and stays there. They own any attacker in that lane.
Because a forward has locked down the outside, it frees one of the defensemen to slide into the absolute middle of the ice and own the center lane, while the other defenseman takes the puck side lane.
You essentially build a three-man horizontal wall, standing up at your blue line, forcing the attackers to either dump it in or try to stick handle through a mace.
System 3 is the mid lane back check, and this is incredibly common. This requires all three forwards to sprint back hard directly down the center seam of the ice. They completely clog the middle.
By filling the high danger slot with forwards, it frees the defenseman to confidently play the outside lanes without fear of getting beaten inside. The first forward back must explicitly stop between the puck and the net, providing an immediate layer of secondary cover if the primary defenseman gets beaten wide.
And finally, System 4. This is the most physically demanding and aggressive system. Hound the puck.
This is the exact philosophical opposite of the mid lane back check. Instead of clocking the middle, the first forward back chases the puck carrier relentlessly from behind. They harass them, stick lift them, and hound them all the way up the ice, even after the carrier makes a pass.
The defensemen hold a tight inside position and protect the slot, trusting the hounding forward to cause chaos.
If a coach wants maximum pressure everywhere on the ice to force turnovers, they run the hound. But the source text provides a severe tactical warning about a specific failure point in this system. What happens when the hounding forward simply cannot skate fast enough to catch the puck carrier by the time they reach the blue line?
You end up with total confusion. You have a forward chasing from behind and a defenseman waiting in front, and both of them are hovering around the puck carrier, completely unsure of who is supposed to take the physical engagement.
Yeah, right. They paralyze each other. Teams that run the hound effectively must have a strict, vocalized handoff rule.
For example, the coach will say, if the hounding forward isn't physically level with the carrier's hips by the center red line, the defenseman must take over the primary assignment, and the forward must immediately peel off and find a new man.
Without that rule, the hound system creates the very chaos it's trying to prevent.
But there is a much darker physical danger to the hound system, which brings us back to our legal IQ. If you are hounding the puck carrier, you are, by definition, chasing them from behind.
If that carrier is heading deep into their offensive zone, toward the end boards, and you finish your aggressive hounding pressure with a physical shove or a hit into their back, you have just crossed the line into one of the most heavily penalized and dangerous acts in hockey.
Checking from behind. The coaching instruction to hound a player is an instruction about skating speed, stick pressure, and angling. It is absolutely never an instruction to finish a physical check into a player's back.
The manual is uncompromising here because the physics of hitting a player from behind, near the boards, often result in catastrophic head and neck injuries. Because of that reality in the NHL and IIHF rulebooks, there is absolutely no provision for a simple 2-minute minor penalty for checking from behind. It simply does not exist.
Wait, really? Let's clarify that. If I'm playing in an international IIHF game and I check someone from behind, I can't just sit in the box for 2 minutes.
No. The absolute minimum penalty a referee can assess is a 5-minute major penalty accompanied by an automatic game misconduct. You are ejected from the game immediately, regardless of your intent.
NHL rules 43.3 and 43.5 make this major penalty mandatory if the hit is from behind.
The IIHF rule 43.3 allows a referee discretion if the hit is merely a push, but if they deem it reckless endangerment, the major and the game misconduct are automatic.
What about in North America? How do USA Hockey and Hockey Canada handle this defensively aggressive play?
They do write a minor penalty into their rules, but it is never a bare 2-minute minor. You cannot just kill it off and come back. Under USA Hockey Rule 608, a minor penalty for checking from behind must be paired with an additional 10-minute misconduct. You are sitting for 12 minutes minimum.
Under Hockey Canada Rule 7.5, a minor penalty is paired with a game misconduct, meaning even the smallest infraction ejects you from the game.
And the manual points out a critical geographic distinction in USA Hockey's rulebook regarding the boards.
Yes. USA Hockey's casebook explicitly removes even the option of that minor penalty if the hit occurs in what they define as the danger zone, the ice extending 10 feet out from the boards.
If you hound a player and arrive at speed into their back while they are in that 10-foot danger zone heading for the wall, the referee is mandated to assess a major plus a game misconduct or a match penalty.
So the takeaway for our listener trying to master the hound system is crystal clear. Use your feet to apply speed pressure, use your stick to disrupt the puck, and use your geometry to angle them off, but never, ever make physical body contact with their back.
The legal and safety consequences are catastrophic for both the player you hit and your own team.
Exactly. Okay, before we dive into the specific math of odd man rushes, let's lock in the back-checking framework.
Back-checking is not just an effort metric. It is a highly structured team system. You must know which of the four systems your team is running.
If you are playing a standard lane system, scanning for the invisible middle lane driver is your absolute highest priority. You must fight the psychological urge to stare at the puck, and you never abandon your assignment to chase a puck carrier that your defenseman is already fighting.
And finally, hounding means skating and sticking, not hitting from behind.
Excellent. Now we reach the crucible, section 4 of our deep dive, numerical situations. We have established individual physical skills with gap control, and we've built team structure with back checking. Now we have to apply these tools to specific numerical disadvantages on the rush, escalating in threat level.
Let's start with the baseline, the one-on-one, one attacker against one defender. This is where you'd synthesize everything from gap control.
You generate backward speed, you maintain a tight gap, you stare at their chest to avoid getting dangled, and you use your physical positioning to steer them outside to a bad shooting angle.
You keep your stick flat on the ice in the passing lane just in case a late trailer arrives. And whatever you do not lunge. Lunging is a casino bet where the house almost always wins.
Next is the one-on-two. One attacker coming down the ice against two defenders. The text refers to this as the luxury case, but it notes that teams waste this luxury constantly.
How does a team with a massive mathematical advantage mess up a one-on-two?
By falling victim to the puck magnet again. It's that same visual psychology. If both defenders lock their eyes on the one attacker and both drift toward the puck carrier, they completely collapse their structural integrity.
They leave the entire width of the ice behind them wide open. If a second attacker arrives late to the play, they have a massive, uncontested runway to the net.
So how do you execute it properly?
Communication is the essential tool here. One defender, usually the one closest to the puck side, must vocalize, "I've got him." They step up and play the puck carrier tightly, exactly like a standard one-on-one.
The other defender must actively resist the urge to help. They stay back, hold the middle of the ice, and explicitly act as a safety valve, scanning for that late trailer who hasn't arrived yet.
Okay, now we reach the headline situation. This is the scenario every defenseman is judged on by fans and coaches, and the one that causes the most debate in arenas worldwide. The two-on-one. Two attackers, one lone defenseman, and the goalie.
The standard coaching convention, the absolute default system taught in the manual and utilized by the vast majority of professional teams, can be summarized in one blunt sentence. Take away the pass and give up the shot.
I want to really dig deep into the why here, because this goes against every instinct a competitive athlete has.
If I am a defenseman, my fundamental desire is to stop the puck from going in the net. I want to be the hero. I want to position my body to block the shot and use my stick to block the pass. Why am I deliberately conceding a clear shot on my own goalie?
It all comes back to the biomechanics of the goaltender that we discussed in the very beginning. Your goalie can usually save a direct shot, but they are physically incapable of saving a well-executed cross-ice pass.
Let's break down the physics. On a straight shot coming from the wing, the goalie has time to track the puck all the way from the blade. They are square to the shooter, their feet are set, and they are balanced.
High-level goalies are intensely trained to make that specific save, and they expect you to let them make it.
But the pass changes the math entirely.
Completely. On a cross-ice pass, the puck travels horizontally across the slot, much faster that a human being wearing 40 pounds of pads can slide.
The goalie is forced to push violently across the crease, laterally. They arrive late, they are off balance, they cannot set their edges, and they are often still physically sliding when the attacker shoots the puck.
A backdoor tap-in to an open half of the net is essentially an unsavable shot.
So the tactical math isn't which option is a better scoring chance for the attacker. The math is which scoring chance is physically possible for my goalie to stop.
Exactly. And executing this requires a strict, unbreakable two-person psychological contract between the defenseman and the goalie. The manual insists that defensemen and goalies must literally say this contract out loud to each other before the game begins.
The contract is this. The defenseman absolutely owns the pass. The goalie absolutely owns the shooter. Neither player tries to cover both.
If you try to do both, you fail at both. If I'm the defenseman and I decide to drift a few feet toward the shooter to try and heroically block the shot, the passing lane instantly opens up behind me.
The pass gets through to the back door, and my goalie is completely stranded with no chance to make the save.
Conversely, if the goalie doesn't trust me and cheats off their angle to prepare for the pass, the shooter just snipes the puck short side because the goalie left the net open. Hedging your bets ruins the entire structure.
So physically, how do you execute your half of the contract? As the defenseman, you position your body in the passing lane. Geometrically, you want to sit roughly on the invisible line connecting the two attackers, biased slightly toward the middle of the ice.
You hold your stick flat on the ice on the passing side with your arm extended. It is your stick blade that takes away the pass, not your physical body.
This is crucial because keeping your body upright keeps your feet free to continue retreating and managing the gap.
And you explicitly do not try to block the shot.
Never. A half-hearted attempt to block a shot often just results in the puck deflecting off your shin guard, changing direction wildly, and beating a goalie who was tracking the original trajectory perfectly.
You let the goalie see the puck, and you lock down the pass. And crucially, under the standard system, you remain on your feet. You do not slide on the ice unless the pass is actually released and you are desperately trying to intercept it.
But wait, the manual presents a highly controversial alternative to this standard system. The time slide. There are coaches out there who want you to do the exact opposite of staying on your feet.
Yes, and this highlights why you must explicitly know what system your specific coach demands. The time slide is a radically different philosophy, where the defender intentionally throws their body down and slides across the passing lane to completely, physically eliminate the possibility of a pass, violently forcing the puck carrier to shoot.
The source text highlights the immense tactical and physical risks of this maneuver. If you misjudge the speed of the attackers and you slide too early, the friction of the ice stops you.
You are now lying stationary on your stomach while the play continues around you. You are completely removed from the game. Both the pass and the shot are now wide open, and if there's a rebound, you can't get up fast enough to clear it.
But more importantly, the manual dives deep into the severe penalty labyrinth of leaving your feet. If you get the geometry wrong, you aren't just out of the play, you are going to the penalty box.
Let's unpack the legal IQ required to execute a timed slide safely. If you slide your body across an attacker's path, and your body causes them to trip and fall, you have committed a tripping penalty.
Under NHL Rule 57.2, that is a standard 2-minute minor. But under IIHF Rules 57.3 and 57.4, the referee has the discretion to assess a major penalty or a major plus a game misconduct if they deem your slide reckless endangerment.
USA Hockey is incredibly strict on the philosophy of sliding. Their casebook states definitively that leaving your feet and sliding into an opponent causing them to fall is a tripping penalty regardless of who actually ends up with the puck. You cannot slide into people.
And the legal danger escalates exponentially based on the height of your slide. If your sliding body catches the attacker low on their legs, it is no longer legally considered tripping. It becomes a completely different, much more severely penalized infraction called clipping.
Clipping. That word just sounds structurally dangerous to the knees.
It is, which is exactly why the penalties escalate so drastically. The NHL and IIHF define clipping as the act of throwing the body across or below the knees of an opponent.
Hockey Canada draws the physical line even higher. They define clipping as throwing the body across or below the hips. If you clip a player in the NHL and your action causes an injury, a major penalty is mandatory.
USA Hockey is the most punitive governing body here. Under Rule 639, any player who recklessly endangers an opponent as a result of clipping is mandatorily assessed a major penalty plus a game misconduct, even if the opponent pops right back up unhurt.
The bottom line for the listener is clear. A perfectly timed, perfectly placed slide that only blocks the puck is a spectacular defensive play. But a slide that is slightly late or wild is a tripping minor.
A slide that is too low is a major penalty and a potential ejection waiting to happen. You have to deeply understand the physical and legal risks before you make the decision to leave your feet.
And that wraps up the numerical breakdown of the 2-on-1, the key takeaway to sear into your brain. Explicitly agree with your goalie on the contract before the puck drops. Usually, you take the pass, they take the shooter.
Do not hedge your bets, and if your team utilizes the time slide, be intensely aware of the severe penalty risks if you misjudge your timing or your physical elevation.
This transitions us perfectly into escalating chaos. What happens when the numbers get even worse than a 2-on-1? Let's analyze the geometry and systems of the 3-on-2. Three attackers rushing down the ice against two defensemen.
Just like backchecking, defending a 3-on-2 requires all players to know exactly which of two specific defensive systems their coach prefers. The standard default system is called two wide, middle to the backchecker.
Let's visualize this. The three attackers are coming down into the three lanes. In this setup, each of the two defensemen takes an outside attacker in their respective lane along the boards.
Crucially, neither defenseman chases the puck carrier if that carrier decides to drive down the middle of the ice. The entire middle lane is conceded by the defenseman. It belongs entirely to the backchecking center, who is sprinting from behind to catch up.
The two defensemen back up together, sealing off the middle, slowing the play down, and waiting for the cavalry to arrive.
The alternative system is much more aggressive. It is called strong side takes the puck, weak side splits. In this system, you do not wait for the backchecker. The defenseman on the strong side, meaning the side of the ice where the puck currently is, steps up immediately and plays the puck carrier tightly, exactly as if it were an isolated one-on-one.
But that leaves two attackers and only one defenseman on the other side of the ice.
Yes. The weak side defenseman, the one furthest from the puck, must immediately drop deep into the high slot and literally physically split the geometric difference between the middle attacker and the far outside attacker. They are forced to play a desperate 2-on-1 against those two players, trying to intercept any pass that comes across.
And the structural trade-off between these two systems is glaring. The first system, waiting for the backchecker, relies entirely on the forward actually doing their job and sprinting back.
Yeah.
If the forward is lazy, the middle of the ice is wide open for an uncontested shot.
The second system never concedes the middle, but it forces one poor defenseman to guard two people, giving the furthest attacker a massive amount of open room. But here is the real nightmare scenario. What if the two defensemen are not on the same page? What if the right defenseman plays the first system and the left defenseman plays the second?
Total catastrophic structural failure. The ice opens up completely, assignments are blown, and it almost always results in a high-danger shot. You must over-communicate and know your team's designated system.
Now let's look at the absolute ultimate failure of team structure, the breakaway. One attacker all alone flying toward your goalie, and you are desperately chasing from behind, staring at the numbers on their jersey.
The manual starts with some incredibly comforting, psychologically grounding advice for the defender here. Remember that this is your goalie's save to make, and statistically, they usually make it.
Breakaways look terrifying, but they are stopped far more often than they are scored. Your job as a trailing, desperate defender is simply to do the one useful legal thing you can do and then get out of the way.
And that one legal thing is put your stick on the puck and only the puck. You can try a desperate poke check from behind to disrupt their dribble, or you can try a quick stick lift just as they pull the trigger to shoot.
You can also try to use your skating route to angle them slightly wide, but remember, the legal angle ends exactly where physical contact begins. You absolutely cannot push them, shove them, or check them from behind.
Because if you foul a player from behind on a breakaway, whether it's a hook on the hands, a trip on the skates, a slash on the stick, or hold on the hips, and you deny them a reasonable scoring opportunity, the referee is not going to call a simple two-minute minor. They will award a penalty shot. It is a free, completely unopposed shot for the attacker against your goalie.
But this is where the rule book becomes an absolute labyrinth, and it's endlessly fascinating to dissect. Let's look at a very specific physical scenario. What happens if I am chasing a breakaway and I desperately dive onto the ice, sweep my stick forward, and I physically hit the puck first, cleanly knocking it away, but my momentum carries me forward and the attacker subsequently trips and falls completely over my stick or my body? I got the puck first.
This puck first carve-out is perhaps one of the most misunderstood rules in all of hockey, precisely because the legal philosophy varies drastically depending on which specific rule book governs your game. Under the professional NHL and international IIHF books, if you genuinely touch the puck first and subsequently trip the opponent as a result of that play, you are legally saved from the devastating penalty shot. The infraction downgrades to a standard 2-minute minor for tripping.
Okay, a minor penalty. Not a great outcome, but significantly better than handing them a penalty shot. What about in American amateur leagues? How does USA Hockey view the puck first defense?
USA Hockey's philosophy is entirely different and much more restrictive. Their legal relief for playing the puck first only applies to a clear hook check or poke check. Crucially, those are defined as stick checks made while on your feet. If you physically leave your feet and slide your body into an opponent, causing them to fall, the USA Hockey casebook states unequivocally that it is a tripping penalty, regardless of who actually ends up with the puck. A full body slide is not legally considered a stick check. Hitting the puck first on a desperation slide buys you absolutely zero legal relief under USA Hockey rules.
Wow. That's just a penalty. Full stop. And what about north of the border? Does Hockey Canada offer any relief?
Hockey Canada actually writes the puck first carve-out explicitly for the act of sliding. Their rulebook states that if you slide along the ice, clearly contact the puck prior to contacting the body, and cause the fall in that exact same motion, there is no penalty assessed whatsoever. It is deemed a clean defensive play.
Oh, nice. So if I'm playing Canada, I can slide all I want to save a breakaway.
Not so fast. The legal nuance catches you again. The rule explicitly states that the puck first exception absolutely does not apply to clipping or slew footing. As we discussed earlier, if your slide catches the attacker below the hips, that's clipping. It carries no carve-out, immediately escalates to a match penalty. And if your physical action is deemed slew-footing, the penalties are draconian.
Let's break down the mechanics of slew-footing, because the manual spends significant time on it, and it's intense. Slew-footing isn't just a trip. It is the act of sweeping a player's feet out from under them, often while simultaneously pushing their upper body backward. Doing this, especially from behind while at high speed on a breakaway, forcefully puts a player on the back of their head with absolutely nothing to break their fall. It is incredibly dangerous.
Which is why the rule books show zero mercy. The NHL makes slew footing a mandatory match penalty. There's no lower tier, no referee discretion for a minor. You're ejected and likely suspended. The IIHF mandates a major penalty plus an automatic game misconduct. USA Hockey sets a strict minimum of a major plus a game misconduct. Hockey Canada starts at a double minor but makes a match penalty mandatory if there's any injury on the play. The ultimate point for the defender is this. A desperation dive from behind on a breakaway is a total minefield of major penalties and ejections. Do not slide. Keep your feet moving and stick to playing the puck with your blade only.
There is one final mind-blowing rule regarding breakaways that we have to cover. What happens at the very end of a close game? Your team is down by a goal, so you have pulled your goalie for an extra attacker. The net is completely empty. The opponent gets a breakaway toward that empty net, and you commit a foul from behind to stop them. What is the call?
Under the NHL and IIHF rulebooks, if you foul a player on a breakaway when the net is empty, preventing an obvious goal, the referee does not award a penalty shot. There is no goalie to take the shot against. Instead, the referee simply points to the center ice dot and legally awards a goal to the attacking team. The puck is deemed to have gone in the net by official decree.
A literal automatic goal on the scoreboard.
Yes. And note a crucial microscopic detail in the NHL and IIHF rulebooks. For a normal penalty shot during a game, the foul must physically come from behind the attacker. But for an awarded goal on an empty net, that from behind requirement completely vanishes. If you are standing in front of the attacker and you step across and trip them to save the empty net, it is still an automatic awarded goal.
But USA Hockey and Hockey Canada maintain the from-behind requirement even for the empty net scenario. The legal nuances here are just staggering. Every single physical choice you make has a distinct, immediate legal consequence.
Okay, let's touch very quickly on the crease rules, because this happens frequently in those desperation, chaotic scrambles off the rush. The goalie makes the initial save. The puck is bouncing loose in the blue paint of the crease behind my goalie. Can I, as a defenseman, just grab it to save a goal?
You can legally catch a puck out of midair, provided you immediately drop it straight down to the ice. That is a legal play. What you absolutely cannot do is close your hand on the puck, hold it or pull it into your body to smother it while the puck is physically inside the goal crease.
If I smother the puck in the crease with my glove.
If anyone except the designated goaltender does that, it results in an automatic penalty shot for the opposing team. And again, if your net happens to be empty, it is an awarded goal. And the determining geographic factor is where the puck is located, not where the player's feet are planted. If I am standing safely outside the blue paint of the crease, but I reach my hand in and cover a puck that is inside the blue paint, it is still a penalty shot.
Precisely. Let's do a quick synthesis of Section 5. What are the key takeaways for managing pure chaos?
On a 3-on-2, communicate constantly and know your team's specific structural system for who takes the middle lane. On breakaways, trust that your goalie has the mathematical advantage. Your only job is to put your stick blade on the puck. Do not slide from behind because the puck first carve-outs are incredibly narrow and the physical penalties for slew footing or clipping are game-ending. And never, ever close your hand on the puck in your own crease.
Spot on. Now, for our final tactical exploration, we have spent this entire time talking about how to survive the rush once it reaches your net. Now, let's talk about the strategy of how to stop it before it even gets there. We are moving to blue line decisions and preventing the rush.
This all boils down to a critical, split-second physical decision for a defenseman as the attacking puck carrier approaches the defensive blue line. Do I aggressively stand up and hold my ground, or do I passively retreat and back off?
This is a genuine tactical trade-off, and there is no universal right answer that applies to every situation. It is usually a philosophical coaching choice based on the team's identity. Let's look at the mechanics of standing up first. This means you plant your feet, hold your ground just inside the blue line, and physically challenge the puck carrier as they try to cross.
The tactical upside of this is huge. You deny them entry into your zone entirely. You force them to either dump the puck into the corner, which completely neutralizes the speed of the rush, or you force them to turn back and regroup. Mm-hmm. You keep the chaotic play 60 feet away from your net.
But the physical downside is catastrophic if you fail. If you step up to make a hit or poke the puck, and you miss or get beaten by a quick deke, there is absolutely nothing but empty ice behind you. You have just stranded your defensive partner in a desperate 2-on-1, or you have given up a clean breakaway. Standing up aggressively heavily rewards an attacker who has the skill to chip the puck past your hip and skate onto it.
Which brings up a massive physical warning from the manual regarding the psychology of stepping up. If a defenseman sees an attacker coming through the neutral zone with their head down staring at the puck, a lot of players get predatory. They think, oh, here we go. I'm going to line him up and lay a massive highlight reel hit.
That predatory mentality is exactly what leads to major penalties and suspensions. A head-down puck carrier is a tactical read about their field of vision. It tells you they aren't looking up, so they aren't going to change direction unexpectedly, meaning your body can easily get to the spot first to geometrically angle them off. It is absolutely not a legal license to arrive harder, faster, or to punish them physically.
And the rulebooks are waiting to trap you if you do. If you step up and accelerate forcefully through a hit on a player entering the zone, that is the definition of charging.
Yes. USA Hockey's casebook specifically rules on this exact geographic scenario. Skating across the ice or stepping up at full speed to deliver a hard body check on an unsuspecting head-down opponent is charging, because the primary purpose of the physical action was punishment and intimidation, not a legitimate hockey play to separate the player from the puck. And crucially, you don't even need a long run-up to be called for charging.
Yeah.
The rulebooks state that violently accelerating your body through a check, even without taking any fast skating strides beforehand, can still be penalized as charging.
And the penalties for getting charging wrong.
None of the four major rulebooks cap a charging penalty at a simple minor. Under USA Hockey, it starts at a minor plus a misconduct and rapidly escalates to a major plus a game misconduct or a match penalty based on violence. Hockey Canada makes the major plus game misconduct mandatory if the hit causes an injury. So again, use your position to take the ice, use your stick to take the puck, but do not hunt the man.
So if standing up is structurally risky and legally dangerous, the alternative is retreating, backing off into your zone.
Retreating is the safe, reliable, and repeatable system. You match their speed by skating backward, you hold your tight gap, and you use your body to funnel them to the outside boards. The absolute worst-case scenario here is that you concede a controlled zone entry, but you force them into the corner, not a breakaway. The cost of this safety is that you concede the blue line, meaning your team is now forced to defend in your own zone, which leads to longer, physically tiring shifts.
The golden rule of the blue line decision is this. Step up or back off, but never, ever do half of each. Drifting forward to challenge, changing your mind halfway, and then desperately trying to retreat leaves you arriving incredibly late, flat-footed with a massive gap. The manual gives us a brilliant diagnostic question for the defenseman. When in doubt, which should you choose?
When in doubt, back off and maintain a tight gap. It has no catastrophic structural failure mode.
But the absolute best, most effective rush defense is not creating a rush for the opponent in the first place. The manual identifies five common ways that teams manufacture deadly odd-man rushes against themselves. These are the self-inflicted wounds of hockey, rooted in poor psychology and bad habits. Let's explore the why behind each of them.
The first self-inflicted wound is a defensive pinch that misses. This happens when a defenseman steps down deep at the offensive blue line to try and aggressively keep the puck in the zone. If they miss the puck, they are now trapped deep behind the play. You must only pinch on a read, meaning you geometrically know you will win the race to the puck, and you visibly confirm that a forward is rotating high to cover your defensive position.
The second wound is forwards cheating for offense. This is pure psychology. A winger turns up ice and starts skating away from the defensive zone, hunting for a glorious breakaway pass before their team has actually secured possession of the puck. When the puck turns over, which it often does, that winger is 50 feet away from the play and completely useless defensively.
The third is neutral zone turnovers. This is a failure of risk assessment. A player tries to stick handle through three defenders in the crowded middle of the ice or attempts a highly risky cross-ice pass. A turnover in the neutral zone instantly hands the puck to a team that is already facing your net with forward momentum, while your forwards are trapped behind the play, facing the wrong way.
The fourth is bad line changes. Changing players while the puck is loose. Executing a five-man line change when you've dumped the puck deep into the offensive corner is structurally fine. Doing it while the puck is bouncing unpredictably near your own blue line is exactly how unorganized three-on-two ambushes are born.
And the fifth, and perhaps most subtle, self-inflicted wound. Both defensemen going below the puck in the offensive zone. Nothing visually looks wrong until the puck is turned over, and suddenly there is literally nobody back to defend. You must constantly possess the situational awareness to know who is acting as the high safety valve above the puck before you decide to dive deep into the offensive corners.
So assuming the worst happens, the rush occurs, but you defend it successfully, you angle them out, the goalie makes the save, or you force them to dump it into the corner, is the job done? Can you relax?
Absolutely not. The manual heavily emphasizes the critical cognitive transition from rush defense into zone coverage. The exact microsecond the attack loses its forward momentum, you must instantly switch your mental modes.
Rush defense is fluid and lane-based. You are managing space. Zone coverage is rigid, structural, and assignment-based. You are managing specific people. You have about one single second to switch your brain from asking who is in my lane to asking who is my specific man.
And the very first physical action you must take in that 1 second is to find the net front attacker. During a high-speed rush, nobody is specifically assigned to stand in front of the net. But as the rush dies, an attacking player will naturally drift to the crease. If you don't visually locate them and physically engage them immediately, they will be standing alone for a rebound tap-in. Find the net front, switch to your man assignments, and vocalize the handover to your teammates. A rush is not over when the shot is saved. A rush is over when every single attacker has a physical mark.
Okay, we have covered an immense, incredible amount of ground today. We have broken down the physics, the psychology, and the lot of the game. Let's move into our final mastery review. We want to synthesize all of this deeply complex information into a coherent, usable mental framework for our listener.
If we pull back and look at the big picture, defending the rush is fundamentally a progressive geometric funnel. It starts before the attacker even reaches you. You generate backward momentum early to match their speed. As they approach, you establish and relentlessly maintain the defensive side of the puck, keeping your body on the line between them and your net. You read their chest and hips to defeat visual deception. You use your angle to force them to the outside, utilizing the boards as a stationary second defender legally. If it evolves into an odd man situation, you execute your specific numerical contract, like taking the pass on a 2-on-1 while the goalie takes the shooter. And throughout this entire chaotic sequence, you avoid the desperation penalties that come from lunging off balance, sliding wildly, or checking from behind.
The manual provides a fantastic retention list, and we've woven these concepts throughout our discussion. If you are going to commit anything to permanent memory from this deep dive, these are the architectural pillars of defense. Never surrender the defensive side of the puck. It is your riot shield. Start your backward momentum early. You physically cannot close a gap from zero. Read the chest and hips, because the puck is designed to lie to your eyes.
Keep your stick flat on the ice in the passing lane, because an airborne stick defends nothing. On a 2-on-1, explicitly honor the contract. The defenseman owns the pass, The goalie owns the shooter. Do not chase the puck carrier if your defensive partner is already engaged. Find the unmarked man. Always aggressively scan for the middle lane driver and the late trailer. They are the invisible, lethal threats.
Stick to the puck only on breakaways. Sliding is a penalty minefield. Do not cover the puck with your hand in your own crease unless you want to give up a penalty shot. And finally, the rush isn't over until everyone has a designated mark in the defensive zone.
That framework is the blueprint for true rush mastery. It connects the physical positioning with the intense tactical awareness required to shut down the most dangerous, high-probability plays in hockey.
I want to thank you, the listener, for going on this incredibly intense, masterclass-level deep dive with us. We promised you an expert breakdown, and navigating the biomechanics of gap control and the labyrinth of four different rule books certainly delivered that.
It really highlights how much profound, split-second cognitive processing is required in a game that moves so incredibly fast.
It does. And I want to leave you with one final provocative thought to mull over. We started this hour by comparing a set defensive zone to a fortified castle and the rush to a chaotic ambush in the open woods. We tend to think of defensive tactics in that ambush as purely physical or geometric. Who skates where? Who blocks what? Who has the most explosive stride? But this deep dive reveals something much deeper. True hockey IQ is actually legal IQ. The exact physical angle you take, whether you choose to slide across the ice versus reach with your stick, whether you finish a check into the boards or just pin the puck, these aren't just athletic choices about physics. They are complex decisions about navigating a microscopic high-speed line between a brilliant game-saving defensive play and a game-ending catastrophic major penalty.
The rulebook is the invisible architecture that governs every physical movement of the game.
It really is. So the next time you are watching a game on TV or you are lacing up your skates to play in one and you see a lone defender scrambling backward to stop a terrifying two-on-one ambush, ask yourself, is that defender making a choice based purely on the physical attacker in front of them, or are they actually making a highly calculated choice based on the invisible rulebook?